Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind on Relationships.
So that's one other thing that I wanted to throw up. Now, what are your questions? We can just have a conversation, okay? We'll start here.
I have a question.
Just a second.
I have a question about the framework, because it doesn't seem to include family relationships.
Family? Oh, definitely.
Well, for instance, you have committed relationships to your parents, siblings,
yes. Yeah.
But they aren't entered into freely as an adult. They just start up before you're even aware.
Well, let's take a look at family relationships, because there are many. The parent-child relationship is the shared aim relationship, in which, well, ideally it's a shared aim relationship, and there's going to be an emotional component, but it's the parent's responsibility to provide the child with what they need to grow. And it's the child's responsibility to grow. And sometimes children refuse that responsibility, and sometimes parents refuse their responsibility. But that is the actual relationship. It's the child's welfare, and the parents take care of the child's welfare. And within that container, then the child grows. Now, as they enter their teenage years, it becomes a little trickier, because this is where they start to experiment in all kinds of ways. And the parents have to maintain boundaries and gradually cede more and more responsibility as the child demonstrates that they're able to assume that responsibility. A lot of parents have difficulty with that, because basically in those years they have to experience being a punching bag, because the teenager is always testing the boundaries on the parents. And from the parent's point of view, that feels like they're always being pushed around. And it's a difficult period for both. And then in the adult, you enter into a different kind of relationship. And a person I know had grown up with very supportive parents, left home, ran into some difficulties, came back, and it was very interesting. She was back with her parents for about 6 months. And what that 6 months was about, she was in her early 20s at this point, was transitioning from a child-parent relationship to an adult-to-adult parent relationship. So she had to do some growing up.
What I have in mind are the many situations in which the parent, and I've never had children, so I don't see it from that point of view, but where the parent is getting much more from the child than the child should be having to give in the way of emotional support,
yep,
and so forth. And maybe that's an exception, but it's a common one.
You're absolutely right. And when in the early stages of, and by the early stages of life, I mean the first 20 years, attention goes from the parent to the child. And there is nothing which screws up a child more than having to provide attention to the parent. And a great deal of the work that I do with people, and I know a lot of the work that a lot of psychologists do and psychotherapists do with people, is undoing that damage. Okay. Then you have this period from 20, when the child is 20 to 40, 60 or whatever, or the parents, where you can have adult-to-adult relationship. Then the parents start to get old. Now things reverse. And that's how things unfold. That's how things evolve. But if the relationship is to endure in a healthy way, it has to be balanced. And if when the adult, the child is an adult, and the parents demand more and more and more from the child, the child's just going to stop communicating with the parent. That's all. I don't need this nonsense anymore. And it happens. It's not a good thing, but it happens. Okay. Other questions? Yes, over here, please.
That brave subject.
Pardon?
Is a brave subject. It's in community, it's probably the most contentious issue.
Yes.
After that, it's cats and dogs.
Okay.
When you're balancing and you have that, you know, that kind of wobble, that's you being alive and trying to stay up, you're going to have it like sway to either side, one way or the other. And so during that swaying, it's not going to be like still, which what I would say is, to use your analogy, if you're still, that's like each person contributing 50-50. If you're swaying one way or the other, as is normal during trying to balance, that's pretty a normal thing. So often, because rarely is a relationship ever like 50-50. You often have like, someone's in school, someone's working.
Yeah.
And so often, sometimes that'll switch later on and such. So could you talk a little bit more about that? Like that's, I can understand if for long periods of time, like the disdain could happen if that's been the model after for a long time where it's just been 60-40 or, you know, 70-30 or something in terms of the balance. But as far as like that normal flow and such, it's especially you can have relationships like that was, you know, you talked about where you can have that real spark and that's what creates the beginning of the relationship. And so, but you still really like each other and so you work through the tough ones, which can be really bright as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So I'm not quite clear about what you're asking.
So could you just elaborate a little bit more about when things aren't 50-50, when are they healthy, when aren't they?
Well, as you say, things are rarely 50-50, and if they are 50-50, they aren't 50-50 for very long. Because something's going on. Could you take out the garbage, dear? And now it's different. You know, and how is the housework apportioned? How does the income? And every couple, every relationship, this is worked out somehow or other. Sometimes better, sometimes worse. But it's all, and it's an ongoing process. What's important here isn't to keep track of, are we in balance or not? Are we in balance or not? That becomes like accounting in the relationship. What is important is to pay attention to the quality of the interaction. And that's, and not only the quality of the interaction, but also what is happening in you. Now, if there is richness in the interaction, then things are going to find a balance because there's many, many possibilities. So even if one person is ill, and quite ill for a period of time, and which increases significantly the responsibility on the other, with the richness of interaction, there is the feeling of intimacy. So it's never felt as a burden. It's just felt that this is the appropriate expression in the relationship. Do you follow? So that it's the richness of the interaction that's really important in a relationship. And there are some very subtle things that can happen which can move that out of balance. Robert Bly, in a book called A Little Book on the Shadow, describes a wonderful incident. A friend of his says, "Robert, I've been married for a couple of years, and I find I'm growing nastier and nastier. I'm getting more and more angry. I used to be quite a nice person, but I'm becoming quite an angry person now." This is what this woman says to Robert. And Robert Bly says to her, "The problem is you've been eating for two." Now, what he was talking about is that she is, the woman in this case, was getting to express all the anger in the relationship. Not only her anger, but her husband's. This meant that her husband could look like a nice guy. So he got nicer and nicer, and she got angrier and angrier. And so the relationship moved out of balance. And this happens very easily. So if you find yourself, your personality kind of changing and you're coming in a certain way, you've got to pay attention to that kind of thing. That's why I say it's important to be aware of what's going on in you. And it's very interesting when that kind of imbalance is set up and another person starts to own their own anger and not own the other person's anger, the dynamics in the relationship change. It gets very, very interesting. But it can be, I'm just using anger and niceness as one example. It can be any two emotional poles. Doesn't matter. I mean, it comes up with sexual desire. One person gets to be the person who initiates sex all the time. And the other person gets to be on the receiving. So one person has to do more and more of the chasing, and the other person can do more and more of the, maybe tonight, maybe not, and so forth. But that's another form of imbalance. So the person who's doing all the chasing just stops. And what happens then is the other person, you aren't chasing me anymore. And they come back. It's very interesting. What I found, and a lot of people who've explored relationships, is the distance in relationships is usually set very, very early in the relationship. And it doesn't matter how long the relationship lasts, they always have about the same distance. So if it's a long-distance relationship, then stays a long-distance relationship for time. Or if they're, you know, they work out their own rituals. So it's like a dance back and forth. But they work out the distance that they're comfortable relating. Do you follow? So these are all different aspects of balance. And the thing that I think is so important is to pay attention to your own experience. When things feel out of balance, they are out of balance. Now, they may not be out of balance the way you think they are, but they're out of balance in some way because that's what's arising. And that's important to address in one way or another. Maybe you have to be clear about what's out of balance. Maybe it's a story you've made up or whatever, but maybe it's an imbalance in yourself, and you have to have a reality check. These are all possibilities. But you have to pay attention to your own experience, you know. How is it in this relationship? Okay. Other questions? I'm surprised there are so few.
Hello, this is Rick. Conventional wisdom talks about shared aims and puts emotional connection second. That's my impression of what I hear nowadays is that what you don't want to do is get infatuated with someone and then try to have a relationship. Instead, you're supposed to start with shared aims and then the rest will follow. That's what seems okay. to be said.
Okay. Let's distinguish between emotional connection and infatuation. When I talk about emotional when I was talking about correspondence, that's infatuation. Infatuation is one example. Emotional connection is something much deeper. The way a relationship will progress frequently is there will be some kind of interest or resonance or something which will spark it, which may take the form of infatuation. And so two people will start to connect, start to interact, rather. And at first it's just at a social level and then becomes a little more like an acquaintance, somebody that you know. And at that stage you begin to explore shared interests and possibly from shared interests into shared aims. As you do that, and that may be like going for a hike together or going to movies or, you know, creating some art together or something like, you know, it can be anything. Out of that, then you're going to see if connection forms, if an actual emotional connection forms. So the shared aim provides a context in which emotional connection can arise. But the emotional connection is definitely the deepest form. You will not die for someone you have a mutual benefit relationship with. You won't offer your life for that. You may offer your life sometimes for a very important shared aim, like your country, or something like that, or to protect the community, or something like that. You will put your life on the line for someone you love. Okay. Right. Back here, please.
You mentioned the shift, or that there are shifts in relationships. Like, how do you recognize when those happen, especially when you're in the midst of relationship?
Which ones are you interested in identifying?
I guess your pick.
Okay, so you meet somebody, and you go on a couple of dates. You get to know them a little bit. And either they say to you, or you say to them, would you like to go on a hike together? Now it's something different. Or, you know, I do activity X. Maybe it's dance, maybe it's music, you know, or something like that. And they invite you into that. That's where the shift has started to happen. Okay? And then, so that's going from just an acquaintance into shared interests and sharing the interests. And that's getting to know each other. And then you pay attention. As I said, it's about the richness of the interaction. When it's just emotional correspondence, that resonance, basically you're either paying attention to your own experience or to the other person's experience, if you're a caretaker. You know, a rescuer. How many qualify for that here? Okay. Then you're going to be really focused on what the other person's feeling and not on what you're feeling. Alternatively, you'll be focused on what you're feeling and really not what the other person. But when you start paying attention to the quality and the nature of the interaction, that's when things are starting to grow. And how does it feel to be with this person? And just what's your experience of that interaction? That's what I've found, anyway. Does that help?
But as far as noticing, like, which category, if you're going to use those categories, how does that go?
Well, here's the way I use these categories. In the actual relationship, I'm not thinking in these terms at all. When something is going wrong, then I start to use the categories to understand what's going on. And I find that very helpful. But when I'm actually in the relationship, I'm not paying attention to the categories. I'm paying attention to the relationship. I'm not thinking, oh, are we doing this now? Are we doing this now? Oh, okay, now, no, we've got to move here. No, because it's a flow and it grows and it evolves in its own way. But when something's going wrong, like, this doesn't feel right. I go, okay, what's going on here? Oh, I'm taking her for granted. That's not good. That's an imbalance. That goes back to this disdain or disrespect that I was talking about. Oh. Or maybe she tells me, in no uncertain terms, I'm taking her for granted. Okay, then I got to pay attention. Okay, what's going on? So that's when I start using categories, is to understand what's going on so I know which direction to move. But when it's actually moving and reaching out, then forget about the categories. Enjoy the relationship. That's my practical advice.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, over here. Could you pass the mic, please?
I'm realizing through listening to you that I come highly predisposed to imbalance in my relationships.
To imbalance?
Imbalance.
Okay.
Because my natural tendencies and things I learned, I think, in my childhood are solitude and isolation, in which the relationship lives out in my mind more than it lives out in what you're describing as the richness of the intimacy, interaction. I think I've been aware of this in other ways, but as it relates to relationships. So I'm looking, obviously, to grow past that if you could share anything, point me in the right direction. Thank you.
Well, I think there are a couple of factors to consider here. What kind of interactions do you enjoy? That would be something to pay attention to. And you also may find that a person that you're going to have a good relationship with is also a person who enjoys their own space. And so you can meet and enjoy time together, but you don't have to be connected or doing something together all the time. But other people, they want a very, very rich interaction. And you remind me a bit of a student I had many, many years ago. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. He's a beautiful thinker. I just loved listening to how he thought. But he was looking for a relationship, and he ended up going to a conference. He was in computer graphics and hooking up with an old friend of his from college, and they had a wonderful time together. And he'd been going on to me for some months about how he wanted a relationship. And so he came into my office and said, we had this wonderful time together, Ken, and I really look forward to seeing her again, but she keeps calling. And I said, well, yeah, you wanted a relationship, right? And he said, yeah, well, it means you relate. And he went, oh, no. Yes, be careful what you wish for. So, I mean, some of the stuff that we grow up with is, we can change, but it's actually, some of it's quite difficult to change. And that's why I'm not saying, you know, just get over it and enjoy being with people. You have to look at how does life work for you and find people for whom that's also going to work. And there's always going to be you want to have some tension there, because the tension is what leads to growth, and growth is what makes the relationship dynamic and interesting, things like that. You actually both grow in ways that you didn't know you could. I mean, a couple that I did a bit of counseling for, they're having a lot of tension, and the guy finally looked at his wife and said, you know, and because I was saying, why do you want to be together? And he just looked at her and said, when I'm with you, I am the person that I want to be. And she went, oh, that sounds good. Because that's what she brought out of him. And so that was very powerful. Okay. Yes.
Relationships, I mean, when I was growing up, it was told to me that I would have all these relationships, and the relationships would make me a whole person and whatnot. And I think that's true for a lot of people. But, and I have had long relationships, but I find in the last 20 years for sure that I'm very happy without a relationship. And part of that happiness is shedding those stories from my past, that in order to be a whole person, I needed to be in a relationship. And I think this is very disturbing to a lot of people, that what they want ultimately is a relationship, rather than just a wholesome relationship with themselves.
Yeah. This is very complex, and there are several different things going on here. So I'm going to put this in kind of a big framework. Life is a mystery. And speaking for myself, the more I learn about it, the less I know. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that each of us has our own individual experience and our own path of evolution in our lives. And that's one of the reasons, and I said I was going to put this in a big context, I no longer like to prescribe a course of practice, spiritual practice or meditation practice to someone, because I don't know whether it's the right one for them. And so when I meet a person, I will, as I talk with them, I'll make some suggestions. They'll work with that, and then we'll come back sometime later and make some other suggestions. And it's something that grows and evolves. And it may be like that for a year, or maybe like that for 20 years. I don't know. And I never know. And so you had a number of relationships. They've been fulfilling in various ways. And at this stage of your life, you're looking at things very differently. when people say a relationship makes you a whole person, what people are expressing is their experience of relationship. However, it can easily come across as this is what you should be doing. But what they're really doing is expressing, telling you what has worked for them in their lives. And it's the same way that, you know, a meditation teacher says, what worked for me in my life was going living in a cave for 17 years. And that's how you become a whole person. And it's equally as valid. Because when people make statements like this, they're really expressing what works for them. Or they may be expressing what they aspire to themselves. And when we hear it from here and here and here and here, yeah, because we're social animals and we form connections, we think, oh, all of these other people are doing this. I should be doing this too, right? We get that. You know, everybody else has got a plasma TV. I should have a plasma TV too. It's exactly the same kind of thinking. We get, we want to be part of what is happening. That, I find, is a very dangerous thing, because we slip into groupthink and we sacrifice our lives or what is meaningful to ourselves for the sense of conforming or the feeling of belonging to others. And a lot of people have been betrayed by that. So, again, we have to come back to our own experience. What feels right for me? And what feels right for me, as long as it isn't really harmful to someone else, that's what we're going to go with. And when I was building the three-year retreat, there were a group of us who built the three-year retreat that I participated in France in 1976, I guess we were building that. And we were building the men's retreat and the women's retreat, and about a month, a little over a month before the retreat started, our teacher put names on all of the doors, on all the rooms, and those were the rooms we were actually going to occupy. Now, up to that point in building the retreat, everybody worked on everything. But once those names went up on the doors, then it was about 50-50. 50% of the people put their primary effort into fixing up their room and worked on and their spare time on working on everything. And then some of us, and I was in this group, continued to put our effort in working on everything that needed to be done before the retreat started, and didn't put very much effort on our own room. So one November morning, I was walking out to the construction site with this big, big Englishman. And he's huge and he's strong, who's helping us. He's a very good carpenter. His name was Stacy. And I was kvetching about how selfish all of these people were being for putting attention on their rooms. And he put his arm around me. This is one of my great learning experiences. He put his arm around me as we walked out and said, Ken, Everybody is working on their rooms for the same reason that we're working on everything else. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, it's easier. And he was absolutely right. It was easier for me to work on all of the other projects than figure out what I was actually going to do with my room. For the other people, it was easier for them to take care of their own space than to work on all of the other projects. And these are individual differences. One isn't right and one isn't wrong. And that's why I'm bringing this up. For me, I was coming from a very judgmental point of view. It's wrong to take care of yourself. You should take care of everybody else first. That's got me into a lot of trouble, frankly. Over and over again. And this goes back to your point about balance. If you just take care of yourself, then you're a selfish person. If you just take care of everybody else, you're also a selfish person. But in a very different way. Because there are always the two. There's ourselves and everybody else. So we have to find our own way through this. So I think you bring up a really important point. We hear all of these things, and we get these ideas, I should be this, or I should be this, or I should be that. We have to keep coming back to our own experience. Because in the end, and this is very important, in the end it's our life, and we're the only one who experiences it. Okay? That help?
Yeah, that's great. That's where I came from. I'm not going to waste my life worrying about a relationship that it doesn't exist.
That's a good idea.
So I'm not down on relationships. I just have other things to do.
Okay, yeah. And when you run out of those other things to do? Okay, all right. We have time for one more question. Anybody? Please.
I find what is difficult is to keep saying to myself, am I being honest with myself about, you know, where I'm at in relationships and transactional relationships that get, you know, I'm going to make a lot of money off this and get blinded to it, or emotional relationships of, you know, am I treating that person well. And I also find that I have a lot of presupposed ideas that no one's going to be able to help me. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I went out and I asked three consecutive people that whether they'd help me with my business, and just instantly they'd say, you know, I'd love to, I'm honored. And it's just like, wow, that was unexpected. Yeah. So it just is how I can go through life without having, you know, sort of preconceived ideas about things, or saying, are my ideas honest with who I want to be and who I am?
Okay. Well, there are essentially two questions you're asking there, I think. The first one about being honest with ourselves, this is surprisingly tricky. There's a good deal of research which shows that being able to deceive yourself is very helpful for getting ahead in life. Because then you can deceive others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one of the ways I've found for myself that is helpful is to drop the notion that I am an entity. I am one thing. And to embrace the idea that there are many, many parts of me, and that they don't always agree. In fact, they generally don't agree. And this, I find, prevents reduces the extent to which I suppress material, which is when we start deceiving ourselves. And we ask, am I being honest with myself? If we say, well, part of me feels this, and 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 we have all of those different feelings, and we just say, okay, that's what's going on, rather than saying, well, you know, I feel this, then we can't relate to any of those other parts. Or I think this, I think that, the part of me thinks this, part of me thinks this, part of me thinks this, part of me thinks this. You know, I'm saying four or five here, there may only be two or three. But you keep opening to everything that you're experiencing. Then there's less likelihood that we'll be dishonest with ourselves because we're not thinking of ourselves as one entity. You follow? Mm-hmm. Now, second question. Yes. How do we work with our, and this was implicit in your question as well, how do we work with the conditioning with which we've grown up with? And in your case, there's some conditioning about not trusting others, right?
Well, not really not trusting, just I can do everything myself.
I have to do everything myself. Okay, so same thing in different words. Yeah, okay. Would you agree? Yes. Now, the way that I work with those, where there are three places here. Whatever we don't notice is an area where our conditioning operates very strongly because it's stopping us from seeing things. Now, that's a very difficult one to identify, and basically we need somebody else to point that out to us. Life will point it out to us, but it usually doesn't do it very gently. And again, going back to my retreat experience, I got very, very ill in retreat. And basically it boiled down to my body saying, Ken, you can go and get enlightened if you want. I'm not coming. And that's why I say it's not very gentle about that. So it's much better if we actually listen to other people say, you know, I think you should put more attention on your body. You know, and we may be like, what the hell does that mean? And my old office partner, who had all kinds of flaws, but he had a really, really good heart, and he was quite successful in his business. And one day he just came into my office and said, Ken, I've just been watching you. You have a time management problem. I said, I do? Yeah. And he just went, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And I went, oh, gee, I guess you may be right. I hadn't noticed how much I was being pulled in 15 million different directions. And so I started to pay attention to that. But that was, he was pointing out something I wasn't noticing. And I was old enough that I actually listened to him. So, what we don't notice. Next one is what we don't question. If there's an area of your life that you never question, that's almost certainly an area where your conditioning is running quite strongly. I never thought about that. Well, that's just how it is. That's the language of patterns. That's the language of fixed ideas. That's the language of conditioning. I never do something like that. Whenever you have those absolute statements coming in, that indicates that a pattern is talking. The third one is what you can't laugh at. And, Queen Victoria, we are not amused. And I had this several years ago. I went on a canoe trip with my two brothers. And that kids and it was great fun. But we came to this transition between two lakes, in which one lake was probably 6 inches higher than the other. So there's a couple of hundred yards of really strong water. It wasn't rapids. It was just really strong water flowing out. And we came into it late in the day. And my younger brother and his wife were paddling in their canoe. Had not realized where they were, and they started paddling up this, and the canoe flipped. So that's where we camped that night, dried everything out, no problems. Next day, we had to line the canoes up, haul them up by a rope, because it was just too strong to paddle. So we got up into the upper lake. And then I said to my two brothers, well, just for fun, why don't we take one of the canoes, get all the stuff out of it, and just see if we can paddle up this thing. So got our life jackets, empty canoe, three strong guys paddling away. And so the first time we go up, my older brother, who doesn't have a good sense of humor, is in the stern calling out directions, and my younger brother and I are just, and we get up and get up, and there we are paddling as hard as we can, and we're going nowhere because the water's current's so strong. And then we just turn slightly, and bang, we're under the water. I rolled over, you know, and I come up, and there's the canoe upside down. Well, neither of my brothers are around. And then my younger brother pops up, and he's laughing. So where's our older brother? Yeah. 1 minute, 2 minutes. Where is he? And eventually he pops up, and he looks at the two of us, and we're just laughing. He said, "I thought we were trying to do something serious here." There's a little bit of conditioning in that. So, what you don't notice, what you don't question, what you don't laugh at, those are the areas to put attention. Because if you can't laugh about it, it's life's too short. Okay, we should close here. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope you found this a little bit helpful, and if not helpful, at least slightly entertaining. Have a wonderful day. We've got a beautiful day here, and if you're taking someone close to you out this evening, then I hope you have a wonderful time with that. By way of closing, let's just take a moment or two, sit together, and whatever goodness comes out of our interaction today, don't think of holding it just in you. Let it to spread to everything in your world, so that it can awaken good throughout the whole world. Okay? Goodness comes from this practice we've done. Let me not hold it just in me. Let it spread to all that is known and awaken good.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.